hppodcraft.com.
Dr. Merson looked at the dying rat and decided that should he delay his experiment longer, it would be dead before morning. He had nursed it now for 6 months, and it had been very old and blind when he had bought it. He had told Briggs that he would give him £5 for the oldest rat in Belsham, and the rat catcher had earned his money. It had surprised him, when he had first approached the subject, to realize how difficult it would be to find an animal that was really old and feeble. He had to observe that nature does not encourage the prolongation of pain and weariness. When youth goes, life very quickly follows. But he knew that, in the course of their age-long warfare with the human race, the rats had arrived at some social organization, and had adopted some of our practices, and, in particular, that when a disease of blindness, to which they are very liable, attacks them, they may be nursed and fed by members of their family, so that life is prolonged to an age which would otherwise be impossible.
Well, look at that. Finally, we arrive at a fact about rats that is commendable. It's not creepy. It doesn't cause fear. They have strong family bonds and they care for their elders.
Aww.
Which is great. Yeah, I mean, we've basically been running attack ads on rats for the last few months. So I'm happy to be able to say something positive about those little mammalian critters.
Yeah, it's great that we can say something positive about vermin. That was the opening of The Rat by S. Fowler Wright.
Yes, and it was also the beginning of the end for you rats. Your fondness for your friends will be your downfall.
Now we could take rat hostages. I never knew we could do that before.
That's
but
right.
It'll work because they care.
Once you reveal that you care, then that's when the bad guys can get you.
True.
But before that grand plan plays out, we are going to discuss this story, The Rat, here on the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast. It's Creature Feature February. I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
And I'm Chris Lackey, and oh diggity, this is a heavy story.
Yes.
I got my brain juices flowing, and it might have actually changed my views on mortality.
Oh, wow. This was another story I grabbed from Dashiell Hammett's anthology, Creeps by Night. All I knew was the title and that it was science fiction, so I thought, I mean, that's why I included it in Creature Feature February. I thought maybe we're going to be dealing with some kind of giant rat or a man rat of some kind.
Who was that reader?
Why, that was Mike Queller, host of the Weird Tales podcast.
Oh.
Where you can hear full readings of many weird fiction stories by Lovecraft, Mackin, Blackwood Chambers, all those hunky horror guys. They do all their stories there. That's at theweirdtalespodcast.podbean.com. Check it out. And thank you, Mike, for reading for the show.
Thank you so much, Mike.
So, The Rat by S. Fowler Wright. I haven't heard of this author before, and we haven't covered him on the show. What's the deal with him?
His name was Sidney Fowler Wright, and he was born in 1874, a long time ago, in Smethwick, England. He left school at age 11 and became scholastic on his own when he wasn't working. He was into having a healthy lifestyle, exercised a lot, ate right, rarely drank. He was married twice, but his first wife passed away. With his second wife, I guess combination of his first and second wife, he had a total of 10 children.
I'm not sure if having 10 children is part of a healthy lifestyle. Could maybe stand to moderate a little bit there.
He also helped found the Empire Poetry League in 1917, but began writing science fiction in the 1920s. He was critical of modern industrial civilization and wrote about that in a 1932 collection, The New Gods Lead, which this story is from.
Yeah, within that book, he was critical. Well, it seems like he had a lot of anxieties about the modern world, and that's where a lot of good science fiction comes from.
Yeah.
In that book, he was also very critical of cars.
Mm-hmm.
Thought that that was possibly the downfall of civilization. He might be right about that.
Yeah.
He was also critical of birth control, which should be of no surprise to anybody considering the size of his brood.
He died in 1965 at the ripe old age of 91, so I guess the healthy living worked out for him.
Yes, and that he also spent his waning years apparently in a nursing home that was run by rats. So he got that tender loving care.
Now let's get into the story because there is a lot to talk about.
Yes.
It begins with Dr. Merson. He is a physician who's also doing medical experiments. He's gotten an old rat on which he is testing a serum. The rat is a wild rat that is decrepit and blind, and the formula he's testing is supposed to reverse the aging process.
This rat is so old that it's too weak to crawl toward the tempting food that was offered. He also states it was so dull with age that it did not flinch when the needle pricked it. Those are the only two examples, though. I was surprised there wasn't a third comment on the rat's age here. Like, you know, maybe the rat was so old that its social security number was one. This rat was so old he knew the Burger King when he was a prince. Something like that.
Yeah, maybe not quite like that. He discusses the test and experiment with his wife, who doesn't really seem to understand the implications of such a discovery.
That rat is so old. When it was born, the Dead Sea just had a little flu. How about that?
That's pretty good.
Yeah. All right. After 6 months, he can see that the rat is going to die, this old rat that he purchased. So he starts his experiment by giving it the serum. And the very next day, there's an oh-so-slight improvement in the rat. And even though he generally doesn't like to discuss his experiments, he's excited enough that he's going to talk to his wife about this.
She says, you know, what wants to live when they're old?
Yeah.
That's kind of her take on the whole thing. But what he's trying to explain to her is that you won't be old. You'll be in your early 20s for the rest of your life. But she doesn't seem to get it. But more than that, she's just not interested.
There's truth behind what he's saying, though, right? The way that he describes it. I'm no scientist, but I know that there are all sorts of people right now studying animals who have cells that don't break down the way they do for us.
Mm-hmm.
Like lobsters, for example, who have really long lives. Researchers all over are looking at genetic and cellular ways to stop or reverse aging. It's not really science fiction. I don't know what kind of experiments were going on when he wrote this story.
Mm-hmm.
Every year I read new things about maybe we can reverse aging. Maybe aging is really just a myth. The key to immortality is in shark brains or whatever, you know, or sure, in tardigrades. Yeah. The issues that come up in the story, I think we're going to have to tangle with some of this stuff at some point.
Oh,
maybe
yeah.
Not in our lifetimes, but it seems like it's coming up pretty soon.
Over the next few weeks, the rat's health returns. And at the end of 3 months, it looks like a young rat again. And he notes that he only gave the rat one injection. So this serum is perfect. Permanent. While all this is going on, his regular patients are neglected. His practice is neglected. He is freaked out by this and the implications of having a potion of eternal youth.
He's not your typical mad scientist who just has glee over what they've created and then sort of unleashes it on the world without fearing the consequences. He does the flip. He's not talking to anybody about the discovery, and he seems to actually be depressed about it.
At first, it seems like an amazing thing. Old age would be gone. People would be healthy all their days. People of wisdom would live on and be able to share that knowledge and wisdom that they have forever. Mm. We would be in a society of incredibly experienced people. How great would that be?
Yeah.
Of course, people could still die by violence or accident. He thinks about one of his patients, Minnie Corner, how it would be nice if she lived on.
Right, because she's a terminal case. She's got TB and she's going to die within the year. And what this is what's getting to him right now. He's got the power to save a life. And as a physician, he should use it, right? Because that's the oath.
Yeah.
But then if he's making her immortal, wouldn't he have to do this for her children as well?
Mm-hmm.
He knows Mrs. Corner well enough to realize, it says, that there would be no rest for him till he had conferred the same boon upon her household that he should give to her.
And of course, her young children would grow up and never know age or infirmity. Two of her kids are great, but her third, this kid Peter, the doctor doesn't like. He's got a club foot, but that's not what he doesn't like about Peter. It's that Peter is cruel and mean.
The boy had qualities of meanness and cruelty, which he had shown from infancy, which his mother had lamented, but which she was powerless to influence.
And that is a really good thing about death, is that rotten people will eventually go away.
Yeah.
And this is what really got me thinking, because I have been all about finding a cure for aging, that ultimately it would be a good thing for humanity. But I started thinking about all the terrible people in the world, people with wealth that use their positions of power for personal gain at the detriment to society as a whole.
Right.
Now, those people, eventually, they're going to die. And that is one of the great equalizers of life. Like, nobody's exempt from that. No matter how much money you have, no matter how much power you've got, you're going to die eventually.
Mm-hmm.
What happens if a dictator or despot never gets old? What if they continued to grow their influence and control of society?
Yeah, man, that's a really freaky thing about this. And then also with this case of Peter, you know, the doctor's suggesting that some people are kind of just born bad. You know, you can't educate people into being caring as a way to prevent what you're talking about right now. So there would maybe be a hope that if we give people immortality, that's also a much longer period of time with which to adjust bad habits or gain concern about people.
Mm-hmm.
But I think his point is that, you know, people sort of show up with full personalities. There are things you can obviously do through nurturing that are going to go one way or another, but sometimes people just aren't nice. They're just not nice, or they're overly self-interested, or they've got a streak of cruelty. Just in thinking about this mother and her children, the whole problem gets laid out just in that small example right there.
But Peter, this mean kid, Dr. Merson thinks that maybe not everybody would get this cure. People like Peter don't get it,
right?
You know, like bad people, but then who decides who gets it and who doesn't?
Yeah, who makes that test that you have to pass?
Yeah, and then if you're denied it, wouldn't you be willing to pretty much do anything to get it?
Right.
Again, horrific thoughts.
Well, I feel like at the end, it just like anything, it would probably become a money thing.
Yeah.
People who had the wealth would be able to be immortal. and then maybe there'd be some kind of merit-based thing, like a scholarship type thing where they'd say, if right. you have X number of qualities that we need, then we'll give it to you as well.
Yeah, but if it's this thing, if it's a serum mm-hmm. that can be injected into a person once and then you're forever immortal after that, if it's not right. something that needs to be created and kept, there's no way that that would be kept in. Like once that secret is not, once that formula is out there, there are people that would be able to reverse engineer it, figure out what it's made of, and people would just give it to each other. Also, if people know that they would live forever, as long as they didn't get injured, people would become so careful. They would maybe get extra cautious or extra paranoid because it's like, well, now I could live forever. So if I get hurt or killed or murdered, that's a bigger thing. Like murder would be way more significant than it already is if you were going to live forever.
Right. This is what he's thinking through. You know, if that's the only way people can die, the nature of everything changes. The mechanisms of the brain would be intact if this thing is warding off disease. Mm-hmm. So we wouldn't have to worry about senility and dementia and those kinds of things. But doesn't mean you won't go crazy.
No, or just remember things. Like, you're going to have a longer life. You're not going to be able to remember everything that happened in your life. Like, the more memories you have, the less you're going to be able to retain. I mean, I'm 40 and I don't, there's huge parts of my life that I just don't remember.
Right.
And I would assume, even being healthy, that you're not going to remember all of those things.
Well, right, because you'll hit the upper limit of what the machine can do.
Yeah.
That's what I'm saying. So what happens at that point? You know, the brain is only really designed, it's not, you know what I mean, or has evolved to, you're taking an imperfect creature and you're adding one layer of perfection over it. Now it can't break down. But did everything else get fixed? It's a lot. Anytime we have these kinds of superpower discussions, hey, I want to be able to fly. Well, you better hope that you can also have some kind of temperature resistant skin and that you can hold up against G forces and that, you know, all of these things that need to come with it. So if we just have this immortality, is our box of brains prepared for that?
Mm-hmm.
That's what actually fascinates me, is how crazy would somebody go? I'm sure it would be in some way that we don't understand because we've never been able to see it happen.
So as time goes on, the rat gets healthier and more aggressive. It doesn't like being caged up. It even bites Dr. Merson on the coat. Dr. Merson has this thought. It's like, you know what? This rat's bite might actually be able to transfer the agent. The person that it bites would become immortal, potentially. He's not sure if that's actually the case. This makes having this rat very dangerous.
It's a cool inversion of the zombie thing, you know? The bite actually makes you better.
Yeah.
But that also is just as dangerous. And also because the rat is getting younger, it's Tiger Hates the Cage, baby. It's looking for a way out, you know? It's young and swinging now. It doesn't want to be stuck in this lab.
Yeah.
As it's getting younger, it's getting friskier.
What if it escapes and then it breeds and then it has offspring and their offspring doesn't age? And that would give you a new breed of immortal rats. And the world would become infested by these things. So Dr. Merson is very careful about locking his lab door. These thoughts keep Dr. Merson up at night. I agree with him. I mean, like, I would keep me up all night. This is some heavy, heavy stuff that you have to deal with.
It also hits on the horror and paranoia of discovery, which I think is the most unique and special thing about this story.
Yes.
Because it's something that just doesn't get used dramatically very often. You know, usually, as I said before, a scientist will create something and then we deal with the, you know, how that affects the world right away. But, you know, say just in your garage, you're working on a renewable energy source and you discover it. Boom.
Yeah.
What do you do? Who can you trust? This is going to ruin some industries. This is going to make other people rich.
Yeah.
This could make you rich.
Sure.
Are you going to try and give it away for free?
Yeah.
Once you do that, is somebody going to take advantage of it? I think about like Frederick Banting, who discovered, you know, insulin can be used to treat diabetes. That was in 1921.
Mm-hmm.
Sells the patent to the University of Toronto for about a dollar. And this is what he received the Nobel Prize for, because this is a life-saving drug. It should be widely available.
Yeah.
Now, these days, if you're an American, you got diabetes, it probably costs you upwards of $400 per month to get your insulin.
Oh, my God.
So that idea that this should be free for everybody died with Frederick Banting. As soon as somebody could get a hold of it, limit its production, boom, profiteering begins. So you know that's going to happen once you have the discovery. I mean, that's almost the horror of this whole thing.
Yeah.
I have this valuable thing and all of these people are going to want it. And how do I know who's going to do the right thing with it?
Sure. Yeah. Oh, that is anxiety invoking as well, because it's like,
especially when it comes to element medicine. And I worked for pharmaceutical companies that just flat out said, we've got the best customers because they have chronic conditions. They're the best consumers in the world because they literally can't live without our product.
Yeah.
So if you're going to solve that chronic condition once and for all, you're putting a lot of people out of business, man. You know, there are so many threats to discovery.
Oh.
And I'm loving this story for really exploring that fear.
Well, anyway, he thinks about people that are ugly or deformed and how they might be made young, but they would never have that chance of escaping their conditions. I thought this idea was a bit daft because if you're alive, you still have hope. Who knows down the line if some cure for whatever ails you could be found.
Think about what if you were, you know, like an aging celebrity who had gotten massive plastic surgery and then you took the serum. That's actual surgical alteration to your body. So the serum wouldn't fix it. So you would revert to being in your 20s and have like an eye tuck and weird collagen lips and all that kind of stuff. So that might be worse.
Oh, wow. So with no one dying, people that are severely physically or mentally disabled would be a burden forever. Mm. So maybe people would consider putting them to death. And then again, who would decide who should be put to death? And what if people use this racially? Some kind of white people wanted to use it and they weren't giving it to black people or Asian people or, you know, they were trying to hold on to it and it became a race thing, which is very ugly. And especially when this story was written, that was something that was really prevalent.
But also there's the question of, would people put themselves at risk by going to war over something anymore?
Yeah.
You know, if violent death is the only way to die,
how
are you going to protect this supremacy as well? So all those questions are suggested by this.
Obviously, world population is an issue. Would people stop having children? They should, but would they? And how would the world deal with an insane population boom? I mean, every year, about 55 million people die.
Yeah.
Way more people are born than people die. That's actually receding. The number of people that are being born is lower. I mean, it's still more people than dying, but it's pulling back. And they project that when the Earth hits about 10 billion people, that's going to be the maximum. And then it's finally going to pull back and it's going to be less than that.
Interesting.
Just looking at the way the growth over the last 20 years, because it's been slowing down a lot and it's mostly due to industrialization and technology. And it's just not advantageous for people to have big families anymore. And birth control is becoming more available all over the world. And it's just, it's slowing things down.
But I think about those population issues just day to day, you know, like there are 3 billion more people in the world than there were when I was like 10.
Yeah.
Is that affecting society in all sorts of ways that I don't even perceive?
Mm-hmm.
Like, are there some, I wondered about it a couple of weeks ago. Do we care for each other less because there's more of us? You know, you don't have to be as connected to people in your community because there's always somebody else. They'll take care of it.
Mm.
You know what I mean? Is it contributing to our feelings of anonymity? Like, is there less community because there's more people? All sorts of, I mean, I think about this stuff all the time. So this is why it's such a great story.
I don't know.
And would people then, if everybody was immortal like this and still growing in population, would they welcome the occasional population thinning event? Would there be some kind of purge, scheduled war that would happen? Or scheduled release of toxins into the air that almost played like a lottery? Maybe you'll get sick, maybe you won't, but we got to get rid of half the people, you know?
Well, I don't know, yeah. Dr. Merson thinks, putting aside all these theories of future life, all the speculations or dogmatisms of religion, its only result would be to make the single life longer and the individual lives less numerous. Finally, therefore, it could only be advantageous if it resulted in higher and happier conditions of life than those which were prevailing around him. It would abolish children. It would abolish age. It would make youth perpetual. But would it be youth is what he thinks, because youth is not just a physical state. It's a mental state, a spirit of adventure, of potential. And this spirit of adventure doesn't come out of wisdom. It actually comes out of naivete, where you take crazy chances when you're young that you wouldn't normally take because you don't know better.
Yeah.
But sometimes those crazy things pay off, like big time.
Right.
But that would go away and the society could become stagnant because people won't be taking these chances. The joy of youth is not of experience, but of inexperience. It is because the adventure is new, the path untrodden.
Right.
So Dr. Merson is in his early 40s, but he doesn't consider himself old. He's still strong in body and spirit, but he's not as young as he was. His hair is thinning. He's putting on weight. Would youth of the body give him youth of the spirit?
The author really nails that particular of aging. It says he did not feel old. He was 43. He knew that he must appear old to the young people around him. If he were unmarried and should ask a young girl to share his life, she might make a jest to her companions about it. Like, yeah, you know, the mental state, because I don't feel like I'm 44 you know?
No.
And it's like I've been with Heather since I was 25 years old. So my single life arrested there.
Yeah.
So in any kind of theoretical other life I have, I'm still 25, even though I'm 44, but I think I'd be in for a pretty rude awakening.
Oh, yeah.
If I was back out in the dating world, I don't think I'd fare very well.
I don't think any of us would, bud.
Yeah.
So He thinks of his relationship with his wife and how they met and when they were young, how they were, you know, in that place of youth together. That was the trouble. The inexperience of youth was something which could never be recovered, and the experience of age was no substitute. He realized that to abolish age is to abolish youth also.
Now, when we think of life, it's more than just something that's in contrast to death, but it's something that has a cycle. It has a descriptive cycle to it.
Yeah.
He says the oak tree in perpetual vigor, where there be no place left for fruit time and harvest, for the young growths of spring. If things don't have a bloom time and a bust time, are they living anymore? You know, if you don't have that cycle.
It all seems too heavy for one man to decide. So he considers maybe going to like a panel of scientists or philosophers and that maybe they should discuss this. But then all it takes is one person to let the cat out of the bag. Mm-hmm. And once people know that there is a cure for aging, they will do anything to get it.
They might doubt its advantages for other men, for alien races, for animal or vegetable creations, but for themselves, there would be no doubt at all. And that's so true. It's just the nature of people.
Yeah.
I mean, I get the immortality serum, of course.
Yeah.
But how do we decide who else gets it?
Yeah. So, yeah, it says he imagined himself mobbed, beaten, even tortured till he consented to reveal it to a frantic world.
And that's that horror element I was talking about.
Exactly.
You know, it's treating discovery, too, like it's a murder, because not only – so he hasn't told anybody about this yet, but mm-hmm. there's evidence everywhere of what he's discovered.
Yeah.
So he's got to make sure that doesn't get out either. You know, there's a trail to follow to figure out how to get this stuff.
So he thinks he wants to kill the rat and just move on from all of this and let it die, this whole idea, this whole formula. It seems so dangerous and probably not a good thing to do, to mm-hmm. have this cure for aging. But he has to rush off for an appointment, and he's going to decide later. Now we move on to another character.
School was just commencing that morning when Peter Corner left it. He owed his freedom to his ability to take unscrupulous advantage of the caprice of circumstance and the credulity of his fellows. His two sisters had colds, and his mother had kept them at home. Had he reported to his schoolmistress that his mother suspected measles, he would have incurred the risk of ultimate retribution, which he was always adroit to avoid. Instead of that, he made the remark to Jesse Phipson, who could be relied upon to report it promptly. Challenged on the point, he strenuously denied the truth of the suggestion. His mother had never said so. He had told Jesse that they had not got measles nor scarlet fever. The mistress did not know what to believe and sent him home until she could obtain more reliable information. He had expected that. His expression was almost good-tempered as he dragged his club foot toward Dr. Merson's surgery.
So now, Peter, this is that mean kid that Dr. Merson doesn't like. Now, he's going to the surgery to pick up his mother's medicine, something his sister would normally do.
In that intro paragraph to Peter, it shows how this kid is already a master manipulator.
Yeah.
He got his way out of school through suggestions and rumor, like some kind of Iago. And this is begrudging that he's even going to go pick up this medicine. He's like, oh, this is the price I pay for getting to leave school early.
So he finds the door to the lab unlocked and he lets himself in. He suspects the doc is out and he wanted that. He wants to get in and sneak around and look for anything cool to steal or mess with.
Yeah.
He's not a good kid.
No, I mean, I understand the want to explore adult spaces when people aren't around when you're a kid. But it says, you know, his club foot is actually the only thing that's kept him from doing more stealing. He imagines himself like a cat burglar.
Yeah.
And he knows that Dr. Merson has some living animals in cages that he messes around with or that he experiments on. And that's what he wants to see.
Yeah.
And the door to that part of the lab is not locked, though the key is in the door.
Mm-hmm.
And so Peter opens it, closes it behind him, goes into that room where we know the rat is. It's a quick, effective cutaway scene. It's been set up well because we already know about Peter. We know he's a bad kid. We know that the doc was worried about transmitting the immortality via bite.
Yeah.
They don't need to show what happens.
Dr. Merson is walking to his appointment and he wonders, wait, did I lock the door? And then he realizes that his key is gone. He doesn't have it. And he's like, oh no, I must have left it in the lock. So he runs back to his office. And he resolves that he is going to kill the rat.
That little accident was enough to tell him, okay, I got to just take care of this now. And so he finally feels a sense of relief. Everything's going to be great, which is a bad sign when anybody believes that.
So he returns to the office and we have a break in the story.
We get in the next section knowing that Dr. Merson never did make that appointment he was walking to. And then we get this bit.
The inquest on the body of Peter Corner had been adjourned by a coroner who had known Dr. Merson sufficiently well to regard it as incredible that he should have committed a crime so strange and so inexplicable. He hoped that the doctor might be found, or that his voluntary return would furnish some satisfactory explanation, but the police had not been retarded by any similar hesitation. Within 24 hours of the doctor's disappearance, the dismembered body of Peter Corner had been discovered, and the facts that he could not be found, and that he had drawn nearly 400 pounds, practically the whole of his available balance, from his bank and treasury notes on the previous day, had enabled them to obtain a warrant for his arrest without difficulty. But the warrant had not been executed.
Peter is dead. His body was dismembered, and Dr. Merson left town. His wife believes he would never have killed anybody, especially a kid, but the evidence seems to say otherwise. She thinks that maybe there was some other bad person that had threatened her husband and killed the boy, and then that's why he left town.
Right, because people saw him. It says Dr. Merson effected his escape pretty casually. He was on a train platform going to London. He told some people he was going to buy some unique surgical instruments while he was there, but then he just disappeared.
Dr. Merson had a good reputation, so people didn't want to believe this, and that maybe someone grabbed him on his way to the surgery was a possibility.
Right, but also the servants know that he was home. They didn't. I mean, this guy called and said, "Hey, Dr. Merson didn't show up for his appointment," and then they went to the lab, and he, you know, all Jekyll and Hyde, like, it's like, "Leave me alone. I don't feel good. I'm behind this locked door right now." And then they think, okay, he then dissected the victim's body. It was only when the police realized what was going on and they traced it to his lab that he decided to bolt. That's the police theory. They know he's of good character, but this is the only thing all the evidence points to.
So 2 months on, Dr. Merson still can't be found. They decided to look into the case of the boy's cause of death and are having a public inquiry. Now, at this hearing, Mrs. Merson is there with her husband's cousin, Mr. Reginald Merson. He arrived from Argentina about 6 weeks back, introducing himself to her. She didn't know he had this cousin. He offered to help her in her time of need, and she agreed to be helped. Some folks gossiped that maybe she's having an affair with Reggie, but she seems to be very devoted to her husband. They speculate that he looks a lot like her husband, but about 20 years younger. He's got more hair. He's trimmer.
That is so weird, though. Could you pull that off? I mean, obviously, let's not beat around the bush. This is obviously him coming back 20 years younger.
Yes.
It's one thing in the stories we read where somebody disappears for a generation and then they come back as their own son or whatever. Right. But this guy was gone 2-3 weeks tops.
Yeah.
Then came back as a 20-year younger version of himself. And he knew his wife in his youth, so she would look at him and think, that's him.
Yeah.
Obviously, it defies logic, so I guess that's what would protect you. But
yeah, I guess so. And you know, maybe he does simple things, like maybe he puts on some glasses or changes his hairstyle, grows a beard.
Yeah.
In combination with that and then being 20 years younger.
I guess. I mean, he does. It says he has a little mustache, like,
yeah,
like the doctor used to wear in his youth. Yeah, I guess it's kind of ingenious in a way. He's hiding in plain sight.
Yeah.
How can anybody accuse him of de-aging? You can't.
Of course, it's preposterous. Reggie never spoke of his cousin's innocence or ever seemed to expect that Dr. Merson would return. The inspector on the case questioned him. Maybe Reggie knew where Dr. Merson was, but of course he got nothing from him. He even followed Reggie around, but again, he did nothing suspicious. So even though he thought maybe Reggie could be Dr. Merson in disguise, of course you can't fake 20 years younger.
No. It says a man of 45 cannot disguise himself into an appearance of half his age. I'm like, oh man.
Nope.
I thought I had a shirt that did that for me. Okay.
No. Nope. So during this public hearing, they reveal that the body was dismembered by someone with medical experience. Mm. There was some blood trauma to the leg that happened before death, which was actually from his sister kicking him earlier. But the actual cause of death is a mystery. Reggie stands up and starts talking. And people are a little weirded out. It's like, well, why is this dude talking during this thing? He asks if anything else was discovered in the lab. Of course, since nobody usually just gets up and asks questions in an inquiry like this, they don't know what to do, so they just answer his questions. The coroner says there was a recently killed rat that was being dissected, and then Reggie suggests that maybe there's a connection to that. And the coroner is like, do you know something you're not telling us? To which Reggie just says, I'm trying to help everybody get to the bottom of this. And then he suggests that suppose that the rat had been inoculated with some new and dreadful disease and the boy had interfered with it and been bitten so that he would be certain to contract it and would not only die himself, but he might give it to others. Would it not be a natural thing, even a duty, however awful, to take steps at whatever personal risk to prevent such consequences? And the coroner says, the rat was not diseased. It was in superior health. Then Reggie says to that, then if it were so exceptional in its physical development, might it not have sprung at the boy's throat when he opened the door of its cage, which would be about the same level and infected a serious or even fatal wound?
Basically, he just wants to confess everything.
Yeah.
Right to everybody's face.
And the coroner is like, yeah, I guess, sure, but what's the point of all this speculation? And then Reggie's like, okay. And he said his piece, so he just sits down.
I've cleared up any confusion in the reader's mind, so I guess I can sit down now.
So afterwards, the inspector comes to Reggie and asks, how did you know about the cage? And Reggie just says, I dreamt of it on Monday night, Inspector. I'm rather good at dreams. Hmm. So he's being really cocky about this. Yeah. But then again, what's the inspector going to do? The inspector's, his instincts are telling him Reggie is guilty of something, but he doesn't know what. And there's nothing he can arrest them on. So he just, you know, says goodnight. So it's revealed at this point in the story, if you didn't know already, which, you know, it's pretty obvious that Reggie is Dr. Yeah. Merson. He walks his wife home. His wife still doesn't know it's him. He thinks about giving her the serum. He likes her now, how she is. He doesn't mind that she's in her 40s, but maybe she would be better younger. But how would he explain it to her? Would she agree to it? Should he just give it to her without her consent? But how could he get away with injecting her with something and her not noticing that?
Right. And he is just carrying around a hypodermic needle, a hypodermic syringe in his right-hand pocket that's got this serum in it. So it's a little reckless.
Yeah, it's really reckless.
Still, there was no hurry. There might even be advantages in delay. He imagined Inspector Clausen studying the metamorphosis of the wife of the missing doctor. It would be amusing. Could hardly be dangerous. Still, it was a needless risk. There was no hurry. Yes, he would come in to tea.
That's the end of the story. I wanted, you know, sort of like when the rat got younger and felt better, it wanted to escape from the cage, which seems natural. Mm-hmm. But there was that whole internal conversation about what does youth mean? There's a certain impatience and impetuosity that comes with it. And I feel like with the doctor, as he's de-aged, mm-hmm. he's become a little more careless. He's not having as long. I mean, we don't know exactly what's going on in his head. But it seems that he's a little more adventurous, careless. He's having fun with the fact that the inspector would be puzzled.
Yeah.
You know, these are all kind of youthful things.
Yeah, it's really interesting. And of course, I understand why he did all the things that he did, especially if he wanted to keep this out. Because even if he didn't take the serum himself or he just escaped, eventually he probably would have got found.
Right.
And it would come out, you know, like what he was doing, unless he wanted to spend the rest of his life in jail, which is like, I just stopped the world from the burden of this, you know, nobody ever dying again. So it's like, he's not really evil.
No, but as long as he's got it, he's, you know, the fact that he's thinking about sharing it, he's going to share it with somebody eventually. And then there's two people that know about it and then it's all over.
Yeah.
It's not the kind of thing that would just fade into obscurity, an immortality drug, especially because the people who would take it become immortal. So they got lots of time to spoil things.
This is a really cool story and very thought provoking, super interesting. And like I said, I was all keen on, you know, let's get rid of aging. It's a good thing. And then now I'm thinking, you know what? Maybe it's not a good thing.
We can't know because we don't have it. We don't know what's going to happen. But these are the kinds of ethical questions that folks who are working in that field got to try to puzzle out. Kind of glad I'm not one of them.
Me too. So next week we're doing a story called A Rose for Emily, and that's by good old Billy Faulkner.
William Faulkner, yes. It's a very famous short story. We're bringing Creature Feature February to a close. I want to thank Mike Queller, he of the Weird Tales podcast. Please check that out. We will link out in our show notes.
Yeah.
And I also want to thank some of our patrons for joining the team and helping us get these things made.
I'd like to thank David Larkins.
I would like to thank Trent Alderin.
Hey, Matt Shank, thank you so much.
Jake Reimer, thank you so much.
David S. Runko, you're awesome.
I want to thank Kate Travail.
I want to thank Irene Dels.
I'd like to thank Johnny Lighthead.
I'd like to thank TTT12367.
Do we have droids listening to the show?
Yeah.
I guess so.
We sure do.
Hopefully that's one of the cool bounty hunter droids and not one of the lame serving drinks droids.
I appreciate droids that serve me drinks. You know, I'm not going to spread your hate.
Whatever, Chris. I also want to thank Russ Taylor. Thank you all for being part of the team. We're so appreciative to have you. Yes. That's all we've got for this week on The Rat. I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
I'm Chris Lackey, and you've been listening to the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast
at hppodcraft.com.